Today's episode of Hidden Forces is made possible by listeners like you. For more information about this week's episode or for easy access to related programming, visit our website at hiddenforces.io and subscribe to our free email list. If you listen to the show on your Apple Podcast app, remember, you can give us a review. Each review helps more people find the show and join our amazing community. And with that, please enjoy this week's episode. What's up, everybody? My guest on this episode of Hidden Forces is Hari Krishnan, a portfolio manager at Doherty Advisors in New York, responsible for the VXR VIX replication strategy and hedging solution business. He was formerly a fund manager at Cross Border Capital in London with an emphasis on volatility and systematic currency strategies, and was an executive director at Morgan Stanley from 2001 to 2007, specializing in asset allocation across hedge funds, private equity, and traditional asset classes. He holds a PhD in applied math from Brown University, was a research scientist at the Columbia University Earth Institute, and is the author of a book on regime-based hedging published by Wiley in 2017. Hari, welcome to Hidden Forces.
I'm delighted to be on. Thank you, Dimitri.
This was a long time in the making, Hari.
It was indeed.
This, the last mile here with our technical issues. You know, I have been doing this show for 3 years, and I pretty much stopped doing remote recordings after the first 6 months or year or so because they were full of technical problems constantly. And even when we booked a studio, a professional studio, we had issues. So it's like there's no way around it, you know what I mean? And now with this quarantine, you are now the fourth guest that I've had to try and, you know, work out solutions with. And it's a, you know, it's a different thing. I was speaking with Eric Townsend of Macro Voices recently, and he's been on my ass for months telling me I'm doing everything wrong. I need to be using Zencastr. So we're using Zencastr here, Eric. So I did what you told me, and I like it. I think it's a great program. Also, nothing I say on this podcast can or should be viewed as financial advice. All opinions expressed by me and my guests are solely our own opinions. And as is the case with all of my episodes, these conversations are for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as the basis for financial decisions. So, Hari, I'm very excited to have you on. You have written a book. One is published. I think another one is in the making, correct?
Correct, yes. Yes.
And the book is called The Second Leg Down, Strategies from Profiting After a Market Sell-Off. I don't think you could have come up with a better title for this episode or for this time, because that's kind of where we are, wouldn't you say?
We certainly are. I mean, of course, I liked writing about legs per se, but in a sell-off, there's always a situation where there's a surprise that comes out of nowhere and equities or other risky assets go down, and then people are worried, should we cut our risk or should we prepare for the worst? And what the book was about was providing a prescription for people to responsibly manage sell-offs by hedging in a way that was appropriate given the market condition.
A very, very, very relevant conversation to have. So before we get into not just the book, but your philosophy and some of these different techniques. And I promise listeners, this isn't something, or at least the objective is not for this to be something that only traders or technicians or fund managers with a deep understanding of options markets will appreciate. The goal is actually for everyone to be able to access our conversation. So first, Hari, give our listeners a sense of who you are and your background. How did you get into this business?
Well, I did my PhD actually donkey's years ago in something called chaos theory, which was very popular at the time, and it sort of hit its peak around 1990. And chaos theory was basically based on the idea that you could have a simple-looking system, but if you moved the initial state around a bit, you'd get totally different results. And so it tried to point to the instability of certain systems in nature and in the social sciences. And the financial markets are a shining example of that. Now, chaos theory had its limitations, so it sort of morphed into something called complexity science. Again, I don't want to overwhelm the listener, but the idea was that there were certain networks or complex systems that could become very messy very quickly. And it was based on the nature of the interactions between the players. And so that's how I got into being interested in complexity theory in financial markets and so on. And then I sort of took a detour straight into a market making business where I was one of the first guys to look at off-floor systems for hedging risk for options market makers. And that kind of threw me into the industry. And I really haven't looked back, but this has been a good time to reflect and try and weld some of my knowledge of complexity theory or complexity science and chaos theory back into the financial markets.
Well, listeners of Hidden Forces going back to the very beginning may recall our episode with Brian Arthur on complexity economics, and we've done a number of episodes with people from the Santa Fe Complexity Institute. And, of course, Nassim Taleb pulls a lot from chaos theory, and he's informed a lot by Mandelbrot, who pulled from that as well.
Yeah.
And other folks like Edward Lorenz. So, yeah, it's not, don't feel, yeah, we've done a little bit on it. So don't be afraid to geek out and we'll see where we can go. So let's begin maybe with the book, The Second Leg Down, which again, I said is so appropriately titled. What is this book about and what does the second leg refer to?
Well, when I was working at CrossBorder in London, we had various people who would come in and we would tell them now is a good time to hedge because unlike the insurance business, where the cost of insurance is always statistically overpriced, in the markets, they're kind of waves or cycles of fear and greed. And there are phases in the market where insurance is cheap. But those are typically corresponding with times where markets are going up and people are complacent. So they don't think they need to hedge. And so on the assumption that people would only require hedging when conditions had already become bad and the cost of insurance in the markets had gone up, what was the best you could do? So we tried to account for investor psychology in the way that we defended against really bad downside scenarios. That's what the book was about.
So you're saying what to do in the event that an investor did not properly hedge heading into a crisis.
Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, if volatility is cheap, you can go out and buy options over any maturity to cover any downside scenario, and you'll probably have a bit of theoretical edge in doing it. You might not make money, but you bought them on the cheap.
Whereas, that was a good strategy.
It is a good strategy statistically, but when things get bad, people around you are buying insurance too. So how can you avoid getting into the crowded insurance buying frenzy but still protect? And it's pretty technical, but you know, you can break it down in the following way. Initially, you want to prey upon fear. Not that fear is a good thing in society or in the markets. It's unhealthy. But initially, you want to try and make your hedging profits off the idea that people will take scenarios that they thought were completely out of play. Let's say a 30% down month in the S&P 500. But if the market goes down 10% in the first week, that old 30% scenario down is suddenly in the minds of people, so they might start buying insurance down there and you can sell it back to them at a hedging profit. It's not sort of taking advantage of other people, but trying to incorporate investor psychology in the way that you hedge. And that was a big theme. One of the big themes in the book was you don't necessarily need the market to go down 30% in a month to make money. What you need is a repricing of risk. And the old saying we had was that, you know, people might not want to buy hurricane insurance, but if there's a pretty bad storm suddenly in their heads, they get the idea that there could be a hurricane. So they start bidding up the price of hurricane insurance. And if you own it already, you have something to sell back into the market at a profit.
So you can actually make more money from the repricing of an out-of-the-money option than from exercising an option that's firmly in the money.
Absolutely. It's just a basic repricing of risk.
Because what was previously thought of as implausible, or better yet, impossible, suddenly enters the realm of possibility. So investors want to hedge against it. And because there's a secondary market for these options, I mean, if you could only hold them to maturity, then it wouldn't make sense, right? But the whole point is that you can trade them.
Exactly. Yes. Yes.
So there's something, you know, before we get into all the technical stuff, one of the things I love about your book, Hari, is, first of all, it has something very similar to what many great value investors, the tone of what many great value investors write with. It's very wise, thoughtful, reflective. And the introductory chapter deals a lot with investor, not psychology from like a scientific point of view, but very philosophical. So one of the things I'd really love for you to talk about, because you made this really great point, which is that this book is about how to manage risk when you've already made some mistakes to begin with, in an imperfect environment. You didn't hedge properly. But here's the question. Why would an investor not have hedged properly heading into a crisis?
Well, there are lots of constraints that institutions face and that fund of funds managers face and so on, where the people they have to report to don't say, how did your portfolio do? If the portfolio hasn't done that well, let's say. Instead, they say, show me how each manager in your portfolio did, or how each sub-strategy did. And if one of the sub-strategies is a hedging one, it's bleeding money all the time, so it looks like a dud, especially if you kind of are in a sustained bull market. So you have to go and say, well, this manager's hedging, and the person who you're responsible to will say, well, just take it out because it's costing you money every month, and the guy down the street's making 2% a year more than you do. And one of the points I try to make in the book is that people get really into a tizzy about an extra percent or two of performance in bull markets, but really over the market cycle, that doesn't matter. The real edge is to be gained by protecting capital in the severe downturn while staying in the market enough. But the line item approach, the idea that you need to get rid of stuff that's underperforming, even if it's underperforming for the right reasons, drives the perverse incentive structure for a lot of investors.
And is it fair to say that the longer the bull market goes on, the more the pressure from investors to get rid of what are perceived to be basically losers, hedges, i.e. insurance that's bleeding money but not generating a return?
Absolutely. I mean, you raised a very good point when you made the analogy between my approach to hedging, or what I wrote about, and private equity or value investing, because ideally, hedging should be a bit like a private equity play, where in private equity, at the end of the mega sell-off, if you could pick it, if an investor could identify it, there'd be value propositions all over the place, stuff to buy. And if you had some cash, you could pile it in. If you could raise capital, you could pile it into stuff that was really cheap and realize a big gain over a reasonable horizon, let's say a few years. Insurance is exactly the same thing, but at the opposite point in the cycle, where when people are overly complacent, as they were, say, at the end of 2019, you can stockpile insurance in exactly the same way. And if you have access to capital at that point, you have a huge potential return if the market does turn, based on the proposition that you've bought all of this value insurance claims and they're going to bear fruit at some point in the not too distant future. So that is a philosophy that I think is very relevant, that is kind of an analogy between value investing and value insurance buying in the hedging markets, in the options markets.
So there are a lot of things to discuss. When I asked you to give us your view of investor psychology, we were discussing risk repricing of options and how you can use options in such a way so that to actually buy risk, buy exposure to volatility cheaply, and in some cases sell it also cheaply. This is difficult for someone like me to understand. I do want to get into it, but I also want to throw out a couple other things that I think are interesting at a high level.
Sure.
And one of those things has to do with exogenous versus endogenous factors. Now, the vast majority of people who may know nothing about markets or may think they know a lot about markets, they all connect the exogenous events of the world, coronavirus, 9/11, trade wars, etc. They connect those things with moves in the market. And I think one of the things that, you know, when I speak with people sometimes, their frustration is they say, how can it be that yesterday the attack against Soleimani was the reason why markets fell, but today it's the reason that the markets rose? And I think one of the things that's really interesting is that we live in a world where the media ascribes reasons for market moves after the fact that may have had absolutely nothing to do with those exogenous factors, that in fact, it was endogenous. So I would love maybe if you could also give us an overall understanding of what is the relationship between exogenous and endogenous risk, and how does one feed into the other?
Oh, that's a lovely question. It takes a bit of time to unpack it. I'll do what I can. The media has a different incentive structure from somebody like me who manages money. The media gets paid per unit of news that's latched onto and consumed. We get paid for raising assets, admittedly, but also performance. And so for us, we need to have a good understanding of the way that the market structure is set up and the risk of a random shock that we don't know. We cannot predict that the coronavirus will become as big as it did or that something will come from the outside. But what we can do is say, well, if there is a shock of a certain size, are there going to be a lot of people who have to sell, who have to bail out? And can we model those people? I mean, the network is huge. There are billions of players in the financial network. But do we know who the big guys are? Do we know who the equivalent of the London whale is? And do we know how they will have to react if there's a shock of sufficient size? And what we've seen in the recent sell-off, as well as in many sell-offs previously, is that when there were over-levered, over-concentrated, over-positioned major players in the market who were using leverage, especially, the risk of a major sell-off was larger than usual. So I do not wish to diminish the importance or the impact socially of the coronavirus. But what I will say is that a lot of factors came into play where positioning was very dangerous at the end of 2019. And a lot of the consequences that we've seen, not only in the equity markets, but in credits and other areas, have been a function of that. And one thing that we try and do as money managers, or at least as macro money managers, is to say, well, even if we cannot model all the external factors, you know, Martians landing on Earth, or, you know, the alien invasion story, or pandemic, or some geopolitical event, what do we know that's common to all major risk asset sell-offs? And by risk assets, I mean equity indices like the S&P 500 and corporate bonds and so on. What do we know that's common? Well, they're a function of two things. One of them is too much leverage in the system, and the other one is over-optimistic positioning where people have to bail out in size at the same time.
So those are other two very important topics, credit and positioning, that I want to get to. What sort of modeling is done to understand endogenous factors, and how much experience do people like you have using these types of models, like agent-based models?
It varies, and I cannot claim to be the be-all and end-all in this, but we're all working on it, all the people who are interested in it. The most simple model says, let's assume that institutions like pensions and insurance companies have a strategic asset allocation mandate. What does that mean? Well, every year they have, or every quarter they have to rebalance to 60% in stocks, 40% in bonds. Let's just assume they're stocks and bonds. And there's a huge central bank easing. So the Treasury issues all these new pieces of debt. The central bank, the Fed, buys the debt. But basically, the supply of bonds has gone up dramatically. In the meantime, companies are able to buy back their shares. So the supply of stocks has gone down. What does that mean for equities? And this is kind of a reflection on the period post-financial crisis up to 2019. What it means is that the supply of equities is constrained. The supply of bonds and cash is going up dramatically. Therefore, institutions that have to allocate 60%, let's say, to equities have to buy more shares. They don't care about price. They don't care about value. They don't care about the balance sheet. They're basically in a setup where the agent, the dominant agent, which might be the central bank, has created such an excess supply of debt that they have to go in and buy shares just to balance out their portfolios. That's the most obvious agent-based dynamic, where the central bank is the dominant agent, which is exactly the case post-2008, And its actions have an effect not only on the supply of debt, but also on the cost of borrowing, namely the yield curve. And when the yield curve gets crushed, or when it gets squashed, so that even 10-year yields are well below 1%, people like pensions and insurance companies, or anybody who has a liability stream that they have to meet, needs to chase yield in other places. So that's kind of the most basic version, but there are far more sophisticated versions that I'm sure we'll get into as we continue the conversation.
Well, the chase for yield is something we've talked about a lot on this program with all sorts of people, and that speaks of the credit issue. To stick with this point about agent-based modeling,
sure.
How difficult is it to get, because this is so much about the quality of this model isn't just about the model itself, it's also about the core considerations and assumptions that are built into it or that are used, right? Who the agents are, what they hold, how they behave.
Absolutely.
And so how available is that data? And give me a sense of just how accurate these models can be depending on where that data is sourced and who gets it.
Perfect. Post-2008, the Bank of England had a group and the Oxford University had a team that tried to model the network, the financial network, from the ground up. And that's a big data problem. But my goal, and the goal of some other people who do the same sort of thing I do, has been not to try and model every agent in the system. And there are billions of them. And there are a squared number as many connections between those agents. But to try and find situations where the new financial products that are out there are creating concentration risk. I will give you two cases. The first one is in February 2018, a lot of people were astonished that the VIX went from 12 or whatever it was to some low teen number to 50 in a day on February the 5th, with no real news taking place in the outside world that was dramatic enough to justify that, and no real move in other asset classes that would have corroborated that move in the VIX. Basically, what happened was you had a situation where these inverse VIX ETNs that would short the VIX futures systematically according to a legally binding prospectus and deliver that return were about 20 or 25% of the entire market in the VIX futures. So everyone else who was in the market who knew about these ETNs knew how big they were because they trade, they're listed on exchanges. You know what their market cap is, you know what their size is, and you know what the size of open interest is in the VIX futures. So everyone knew how big they were. Everyone knew how they would have to rebalance if they did try and replicate the index exactly. And so you could make various assumptions about how much they'd have to buy back of the futures if there were a spike and what the impact of that might be. So the ETF and ETN industry gave us clues as to when one agent might become that London whale, that giant agent that would dominate the market and potentially cause its downfall based on an external shock to the system. And that has continued on since then. And I can go into my somewhat heuristic, but fairly accurate, at least in principle, breakdown of what happened in February and March of this year.
Yes, I think that'll be great. Before we do that, I want to make sure that listeners who don't know what exchange-traded products are, like ETNs and ETFs, maybe you can tell us what they are. Maybe you can tell us also what the inverse VIX ETN was. You also mentioned open interest and the point about, well, this might lead us into a question about what is volatility and difference between implied and historical. And but your point about a whale is that a player that's so large in the market that his or her movements, especially exits, can have dramatic impacts on the price of the asset that's being traded. So maybe start there. Tell our listeners in a very short sense, what is an ETF, what is an ETN, and how is it priced? How does it derive its value?
Okay, good stuff. Well, ETFs and ETNs fall under a bigger category, which is ETPs. That's probably too many acronyms for anyone, but ETPs are exchange-traded products. So they're basically vehicles that track indices. So they could track the S&P 500. They could track a broad-based bond index. They could track a commodity index, whatever. But they're indices that are then securitized by trust providers and then offered on exchanges in small sizes so that they should trade like shares. Again, that's a lot of words, but let me give you one case. The SPY, one of the spiders, tracks the S&P 500. And so there's a trust provider that basically buys the shares in the index in the proportions that they're given in the index, packages it up, and then individual investors or institutions can buy it in small slices as though it were just a share of Amazon or something like that. So now Joe Public, no offense to Joe Public, can go out and buy something that represents an investment in the index, paying $250 per share. He or she can go out and buy an investment that gives you long exposure to oil, that gives you long exposure to corporate bonds, high yield bonds, government debt. So this puts more power in the hands of the individual investor, but it requires a mechanism that the trust provider sets up to make it work. And so that's pretty complex, but I can break that down for you as well if you like. Basically, the idea is that when there's an index, there are a few different players. There's the dealer or the arbitrageur, which is a fancy word. There's the trust provider, and then there's the end investor. So let's say we had an ETF like the SPY, which tracks the S&P 500. The S&P 500 has a price, an index price, that varies over time based on buying and selling of the individual shares in the index. The SPY is a security that trades like an individual stock, but it has to have reference to the index, otherwise it doesn't mean anything. People don't know what they're buying. So basically, there's a setup where the dealers in that SPY ETF can either buy the ETF, they can buy the SPY and deliver it back to the trust provider, the BlackRocks of the world, in exchange for the shares that they can then dump into the market at a profit, or they can sell the ETF and do the reverse arbitrage. So basically, there's a mechanism through the dealer network that, at least in theory, should keep the price of the ETF that tracks the S&P 500 and the index itself, which tracks the prices of all the stocks in the index, in line. That arbitrage is necessary to keep those ETFs viable and investable.
So that raises a good point, because in theory, and yet we do see dislocations in price between these exchange-traded products and the underlying basket of securities or assets that they are tracking or purport to represent. What causes that dislocation in price?
Well, the dealers have to play ball.
And who are the dealers?
Oh, they could be banks or people who are very experienced trading the assets that underpin whatever the ETF might be. So if it's a corporate bond ETF, it might be a bunch of banks and other firms that trade on an agent basis, meaning they don't take risk themselves, but they find buyers and sellers for bonds that are in the index. So they're banks or they're specialized dealers in those assets.
They're making a market for those assets.
They're making the market, yeah. They're making the market for those assets. And the idea is that they should be incentivized to want to keep the prices in line, because they get paid whenever they go out of line, and then they do the relative value arbitrage. The trouble is, if things get too bad in the market, yet another layer of extreme event tail risk embedded in the system, because if they don't play ball, if they decide to drop out or to be less active, then the ETFs and ETNs just stop functioning. They don't work anymore. And if they don't work, then the retail buyer, the Joe Public buyer, or the small institution, they don't know what they're buying. They're buying something that has no reference to the asset class that they wanted exposure to.
So let's go back now to kind of combining this point about dislocation in price and what happened in February with the XIV. What could cause forced selling in this space, and how could there be a feedback between the price of an ETF and the underlying basket of securities?
Perfect. This is a related but slightly different point to the one I made, but I'll make it now, which is that there are things called levered and inverse ETFs. And so a levered ETF, let's say it's two times levered. Let's say it's on the S&P 500 again. basically on day one, if it collects $100 of investment, it then goes to a bank, borrows another 100, and buys $200 worth of the S&P 500. Now, if it does that, and the next day the index is up 10%, then the ETF has made $20 on $100. So now it has $220 of exposure, but only $100 of borrow. So it needs to borrow more so that it can deliver to new investors two times the return on the next day. And inverse ETFs work the same way. In other words, if you have an ETF or an ETN that's basically giving you, promising to give you, minus the return of the front month VIX futures, which kind of is related to the VIX index that's quoted everywhere, and the index goes down, then the provider needs to sell more futures. Conversely, if the index goes up, the provider has to buy the futures back. So every time the index spikes, the inverse VIX provider has to buy more futures.
Because the inverse VIX provider is short volatility.
Yes, so they have to cover their risk and avoid blowing up by buying futures back in the market at or near the close. And so if you're an outside investor and you notice that, oh, the VIX futures went from 12 to 20 and we haven't reached the close yet, it may well be that the provider has to hedge that exposure either in the S&P futures or more likely in the VIX futures, which means a huge pop at the close, a huge follow-through at the close based on forced buying. That is pure agent-based risk. You're basically saying, you know who the whale is, you know how they have to trade to deliver the return that they promised legally, contractually to their investors. And if you have any handle on the impacts of buying a huge slug of futures, you know that things are going to get a lot uglier at the close or near the close than they were before. And so that's the easiest case where you can track one major player, you know what the feedback loop is, and if you have any notion of what the impact of trading in huge size in one go to a market that's unprepared for it will be, you're done.
So let's go back to this point about credit and positioning. So this is what we're talking about here is positioning, correct?
Correct, yes. That's mainly a positioning issue. Yes.
What would be another example of a situation where positioning can account for the movement in a market that otherwise, to an outside observer, might look like it's being driven by some other macro factor? Something perhaps recently in the past month.
Yes, I'm going to give you a few numbers here. So we had a big sell-off in the final week of February of this year. And we've had an even bigger sell-off in March. And it might be worth just working through who the major players were, how big they were, and what happened. One thing that we know is that in the modern age, and I'll try and break it down as simply as I can because there are a lot of details here, and I really want to unpack them for viewers because I don't want people to come away thinking that the financial system is overly complex and unintelligible. I want to kind of break it down for people. But there's been a big change in the marketplace, which I discussed with you, Dimitri, offline previously, which is that market making has changed its nature dramatically since the days of the floor traders. Now, the person who looks at the latest collapse in the S&P 500 and looks at the picture that's always there, we'll see a few people standing on the floor of the NYSE, which is now essentially a museum, with looks of great fear on their faces or great stress with the headline that the S&P dropped 4% today or whatever, the Dow dropped. But basically, those people who stand on the floor no longer really perform nearly as much of a function as they did. Market making, which is the identification of buyers and sellers and the matching of trades therein, is pretty much all algorithmic now. And so basically, exchanges, as time has gone by, have changed their model from one where there was floor trading and you had to buy a membership explicitly to stand on the floor, and then you could buy and sell stuff, and hopefully you'd make enough to make back your membership and then some, to one where exchanges offer rebates for providing liquidity. In other words, exchanges will pay you for certain types of market-making activities if you're willing to hold inventory, to hold short and long positions.
When you say provide liquidity, what do you mean?
Okay, well, we'll go through this case that I've given before, which is this, that let's say that there's a market for some products, and finance geeks like to call them widgets, so I'll use widgets. So there's a market for widgets, and there's a company that sells widgets, and they have a stock price, it's listed, and the best bid is 99 and the best offer is 101. So no one, as of now, is willing to pay more than 99, and no one is willing to tip their hand and say they're willing to sell for less than 101.
And the exchange knows this because it's sitting in the middle.
It has access to all of the quotes. So the entire order book is transparent to the exchange, and some of it's transparent even to the buyer and seller. So you've got that. And so if somebody decided they were desperate enough to buy the widget company and they didn't really care too much whether they paid 50 cents or a dollar over what it should be worth, they would just lift the 101 best offer. So they would say, we're willing to buy shares of the widget company and pay $101. In that case, the liquidity provider would be the person who posted the 101 offer. They put something out there, somebody else took it, a trade was done, and the posting of that offer meant that you were providing a supply of that stock that was ultimately taken up on. So that's liquidity provision. When you're willing to quote a market in such a way that other people can buy and sell in that market without being gouged for doing so. Hopefully, without being gouged for doing so. At some point in exchange history, exchanges felt, and this started with Ireland around 20 years ago, that they could get better prices for end users, for clients, by paying people to make markets. And these people did not have to be the traditional players on the floor. They could be, computerized algorithmic trading outfits that just put bids and offers into the exchange. And basically, the way it would work would be this. So if you had an algorithm and it noticed that the widget company had a bid of 99 and an offer of 101, and if the algorithm in its infinite wisdom decided that the fair price was 100, it might lower the offer price to 100 spot 75, let's say. And if the buyer was happy enough with that, they would lift the offer, the trade would go through, and the exchange would actually take some of the money that it would charge to the buyer as a fee and give it back to the person who posted or the entity that posted the 100 spot 75 offer. That's called payment for order flow. And what that did, and again, it sounds technical, but it isn't. It's basically like if there were dollars lying on the floor and the person who could race to the parking lot or the street first to pick up the dollars would get 50 cents on the dollar, there'd be a scramble for that, and people would develop robots to go racing out there for them and pick up those dollars. It's the same thing. It was just a hunt for rebates that was covered under the hood or put under the rubric of high frequency investing, but it was just a chase to get rebates or payouts from the exchange that would be taken from the other side. And that, basically, the impact of that is the important point that I'm making here, which is that that led to a complete change in market structure where, let's say, in the option space, market makers were holding the vast majority of positions that buyers and sellers were trying to either accumulate or offload. So these market makers, who are now much more important in every transaction or in a very high percentage of transactions, they now have positions that they have to hedge. And given the institutional mindset, which is we want to generate income by selling, let's say, call options on the S&P 500 and buying protection on the S&P 500 via puts, created a setup whereby market makers who hedged would compress volatility on the way up and actually exaggerate sell-offs on the way down in their desperate attempt to hedge insurance claims that they were short on the way down.
So rather than acting as a counter-cyclical force, they actually amplify moves in either direction. The dealers basically become pressure points in the market.
Absolutely, big time. And that's the main point. So even if you don't understand every individual detail about the scramble for rebates and the changing nature of the system, what you do need to know, or what I would hope the listener is that would learn, is that a lot more trades are not from an end buyer to an end seller, but via an intermediary who is forced to buy and sell at different pressure points in the market. And that's exactly what we saw in February and early March of this year.
So how much of the move that we saw in February and early March was a result of the exogenous factors that we all were paying attention to, namely concern around supply chains, the collapse in supply, and then subsequently collapse in demand because of coronavirus and all the economic shutdowns? And how much of it was driven by endogenous factors like this particular thing that we're describing here with dealers?
It's hard to say exactly, but there had been 2 or 3% down moves previously. They didn't budge the market, but it seemed like 5 to 10% in that range that really started triggering the selling. So this was a big enough exogenous event, finally. In January, perhaps it was underestimated, but by late February, it was a big enough event that it actually did. It was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak. So I think probably a third to a quarter of it was exogenous and the rest was forced selling. The thing that it's important to understand is that even though there are all of these comments sort of about how the smart money knows to sell before the sell-off, the reality is that most people don't want to sell. Most institutions are not incentivized to be short, especially to bet on an economic downturn, to bet on a sell-off in stocks. They're too busy trying to generate a return. So most people, most large institutions don't sell because they want to. They sell because they have to.
They need to, yeah.
They need to, or they've allocated to people who have strict volatility controls that they have communicated back to the clients and trustees that they have to meet. So it's not a question of the evil Voldemort in the room saying, I'm going to sell and destroy human civilization. It's more of a function of people having to sell, big players having to sell. The hedge fund managers who make money on the short side, they're on the fringes. They're not driving the train. They're minnows. They're not the drivers. It's more the systematic selling of existing long positions than the profiteering off shorts.
So this kind of mixes in some of the stuff that I talked about with Mike Green in some of our recent episodes and a couple other people that not coming to mind. Of course, we did one episode, I think it was 73, with Daniel Ellis on MPT, Markowitz, VAR, Sharp, and stuff like that, which kind of, I think it's relevant to this. But this is really interesting, though, for me, right? Because this, again, that's my point about Mike Green. These strategies work with varying degrees of effectiveness at various scales, right? And so I guess the question is, at a larger scale, one, what is the impact on systemic risk in the market for this type of market structure that we're describing here? And then two, how does someone like you profit from it? I mean, how do you identify the market makers? How do you decide if they have on-balance risk? How do you position yourself in order to take advantage of what they have to do, right? This idea of what they have to do, that they don't have a choice. How do you do that?
Well, back in the day, I used to know this hedge fund manager, and I won't name him, but he had this trend following system on his desk. And I went to him and I said, well, what does this system do? And he said, well, it's a trend follower. So basically, it tries to figure out how to buy markets that are trending up and sell markets that are trending down. And I said to him, well, I didn't think you use trend following as a major component of your program. And he said, well, I don't. And I said, well, why is it there? And he said, well, I want to figure out where everybody else is getting out. So if there's a big enough pool of investors that are applying this system, and they all have to get out at the same time, I want to know that because if I sell a little bit before they have to get out, I can cover my position at a gain simply based on their positioning. So that was what kind of got me into the notion that if I could figure out what the big quantitatively driven managers were doing, I might be able to trade around it. And this has only become easier since then because the proliferation of quantitative strategies has been huge since the early 2000s when I got into that. And nowadays, if you look left or you look right, at least until the recent crisis, you'd see all sorts of strategies that either trade momentum, target volatility, or budget risk based on volatility in a given market. So it's easier now than ever to figure out what other people are doing, at least on a broad scale, and to avoid, at the very least, avoid making the same mistakes that they will make in a crisis, but better yet, to try and profit a little bit by trading around those positions.
So, would you say that we are now moving into a market regime where these types of trading strategies, like commodity trend following, are actually going to be more effective? And partly that's going to be because we're in a higher volatility regime.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I'll try and give a somewhat sophisticated reply, which is that we were in a regime where momentum was king. And the reason momentum was king up until, early 2020 was because so many of the quantitative strategies that had come to dominate the market either directly or implicitly relied upon momentum. So I'll give you some numbers. I've gotten these from Barclay Hedge, which is a pretty well-known database. The assets in hedge funds have gone up somewhat over the years, but all of the growth, pretty much, has come either from these balanced funds that allocate to equities and fixed income based on the prevailing level of risk in each market, long funds in the equity space, merger arb to a lesser degree, and basically just long biased funds. So essentially, what's been going on is that the assets have flowed into strategies that effectively are long bonds and long stocks, but rebalance based on the level of volatility in each market.
Back to
So,
what we discussed in the very beginning of the episode, that if it's a 60-40 bond portfolio and the Fed lowers interest rates, buys up a lot of bonds, stocks go up in that environment.
absolutely. I mean, stocks go up and bonds go up almost by definition, because if the central banks are lowering the cost of borrowing over 1 month,
But the supply of bonds also increases, whereas the supply of stock doesn't necessarily increase, at least not to the same degree. So therefore, you're rebalancing the portfolio in favor. You're going to be putting more money into equities. Isn't that the point?
that's a big point. Yeah. I mean, basically, what happens is that as the cost of borrowing goes down because the Fed is lowering the short end of the yield curve, companies can borrow for less too. And that's great for them because even if they have nothing productive to take that borrowed money and pile it into, they can still buy back their own shares.
And that's what they've been doing.
They've been doing it in a big scale. And that's largely a function of reshaping of the yield curve driven by the major central banks. Now, it's one of those strange things, and it's worth reflecting on, which is that, for drug testing and for various other testing, testing a new car, you have to do years of trials. You have to do thousands or hundreds of thousands of tests. But here you have central banks, and understandably trying to take action in difficult conditions, doing unprecedented balance sheet expansion or balance sheet distortion in terms of what sort of bonds they're buying, with no precedent for it. So it's a completely new experiment, an absolutely unprecedented scale.
Well, Ben Hunt talks about this. I don't know if you're familiar with Ben Hunt.
I am indeed.
He,
The Epsilon
yes,
theorist.
Epsilon Theory. He's been on the show. And he talks about this in terms of the stock market having become a political utility. And I think that's right.
Yes.
And to my mind, Fed policy is no longer really about moderating the health of the economy or finding the optimum level of employment or, or moderating inflation. It's really about sustaining asset prices because asset prices and the level of asset prices are now so embedded in the political health of our society because so many people and so many people's pensions are tied up in the stock market.
Very well said. I mean, there are a few perverse things that we've seen. I know the yield curve is largely distorted by deflationary forces and by central bank actions, but there's another factor as well, which is that companies are increasingly unwilling to borrow money over long periods of time, let's say 10-year terms, to invest in longer-term projects. Their corporate executives are so focused on what the next quarterly earnings report is going to be, they've kind of thrown out the idea of plowing capital into longer-term, long-range growth projects. And this is filtered into politics. Politicians are now more focused on shorter-term stock market movements. I know our recent president is. I'm not going to talk politics.
Well, he's a great example, right? Because not only has he consistently made his calling card to re-election the stock market, but he was actually more focused on the nominal price level of the S&P than he was on the immediate health crisis facing his country. It's really quite remarkable. I'm going to quote a friend of mine, TC. He has the podcast TC Chartcast, Tesla Charts. You may be familiar with him. But what he consistently says is the president wants stocks to go up. You know, so this is also very new. You can't make this stuff up. It's everywhere.
Well, I'm not an Austrian economist, but I do respect a lot of things they do. And one of them is this notion that there's this feel-good factor from just if you took everybody's bank account and overnight you double the amount of money that they had in their bank account, clearly there would be inflation long-term. Clearly the people who moved first and consumed first would benefit at the expense of everyone else. But there would be, as I mentioned, there'd be this feel-good factor where everyone would feel wealthier, even if there were no material change. Yeah, it's a wealth effect. And even through the stock market, there's an implicit wealth effect because so many people have their retirement funds plowed into the stock market. So they feel good seeing markets go up, and they feel horrible when markets go down because they feel it's a wealth, it's a subtraction of wealth, and it is short-term.
Well, it's another great point, right? So the Federal Reserve has been consistently, every cycle, lowering the federal funds rate, the effective federal funds rate, lowering interest rates, pushing savers to become speculators, right? Because the same people that would have saved money for their retirement now have to speculate in the stock market. So their wealth is tied up in the stock market. But now what was before an economic or financial problem has become a political problem because these people become very disaffected voters if the stock market collapses and they can't retire. You know, and then going back to the point about the utility. So, and now, you know, I'm moving us back again because we were talking about positioning, but that's fine because maybe in the overtime, Hari, we can get into get more geeky and talk about specific different trading strategies and methodologies that you can employ in different risk environments.
Sure.
But maybe we can end on this point about credit. You know, we're talking about the dealers and market makers, these big fat whales. What whale is fatter? Who is Moby Dick if not the Federal Reserve? And now we are at a place where I've seen suggestions that we might get somewhere between 6 and 8 trillion. That's kind of the next number of new money into the system because the Fed will be buying not just treasuries, but also corporate bonds. Eventually, they're going to own the entire market.
Well, it's one of those great ironies where, you know, Japan was called the white man's graveyard or the white man's place to suffer, which basically was based on the notion that Japan had this huge debt, but yields were so low that this was unsustainable. But what has actually happened is that Japan is the precursor to everything that we're seeing now in the rest of the world. You know, huge debt levels. Okay, I'm not going to comment on that because that's a political issue as well. But certainly the notion that low yields are unsustainable is no longer valid. And that's been a big driver behind this whole modern monetary theory movement, which is that if you issue your own currency, you can finance your own debt without ever going bankrupt with no real risk. Now, I'm not sure I believe every consequence of this, but Japan actually was the leader in this whole central banking revolution, which exists to this day and has only expanded.
Well, you know, speaking of Japan, I had this great idea. I've had to, you know, reshuffle my guests in light of everything that's happened.
Sure.
And I'm sure you are very familiar because you quote many people in your book and you're well-read. You're very familiar with Richard Koo. Who isn't familiar with Richard Koo? Mm. And his concept of a balance sheet recession. And I wanted to get Richard on the show because I wanted to ask him about this, right? Because I wanted to ask him, how do you apply this framework to what we're seeing today with the latest moves, right? The latest Fed policy moves. Do you still believe in this concept? Are we still going to see a balance sheet recession in the United States because of the overwhelming level of private sector debt? Or are we at a new paradigm? And I wonder about that. That's the big question, because fiscal policy is also going to be much bigger. You know, only Nixon could go to China. Only Trump could do this much fiscal spending, right? If it was a Democrat, never would have passed. So, you know, we may be in this unique place where we may finally get, after a period of significant deflation, lots of volatility because of uncertainty around this virus. I wonder if after that, we might not begin to see some serious inflation, the kind of inflation that we saw in the 70s, double-digit inflation. What do you think about that?
Oh, I love these issues. Love talking about these issues. I'm not sure I like the consequences, but the big black swan or the white swan that's lurking and has been lurking is the idea that bonds will no longer provide protection. So many of the strategies that have made it big since 2008 were kind of long bond strategies in disguise. So in other words, they were equities with leveraged bond allocations like risk parity and so on. And bonds could go down for one of two reasons. One reason is that inflation starts to creep in, and there have been various people talking about that. I'm not going to comment on that because I think the jury is out. We've been in a long period of deflation, and it could be argued that the globalization and the fall of the Berlin Wall and so on were secular or structural deflationary forces that have not gone away yet. But having said that, I mean, if bonds no longer provided the safe haven, which they have not completely in the past month, then you could have an entirely different asset allocation mix that comes into vogue, and an entirely different interpretation of bonds as a deflation play or as a protection play. And I think this is one of the biggest questions. It's not really the stock market at this point. The stock market's taken a hit. It may go down further, but I would expect that volatility is going to come down a little bit as the magnitude of the moves shrinks back to bear market but more normalized levels. But the bond market is the real question. If it no longer provides protection, if it's no longer the emphasis for risk parity strategies, for pension fund defensive allocations, what happens to that market? And if it does go south, given the massive supply of debt and cash that's created with every central bank expansion, does that take the power out of the central banker's hands? That is really a big question. And if it does, there may be no place to get protection other than buying options or buying specific markets.
So you really nailed my sweet spot too, Hari, my sweet spot interest. This is, I think, very much the question, right? What is the risk-off trade, right? The risk-off trade for decades, we've had the luxury of having it be a sovereign security. Back in the 1800s, in the mid-1800s, you would never have considered buying U.S. government debt as a risk-off trade in a collapsing market. This is a very anomalous phenomenon. And, you know, to your point, if we're in a place where treasuries are no longer the guaranteed safe haven, that has significant knock-on effects for the rest of the world, because the rest of the world has relied on the dollar. It's a huge thing. And further to your point, we did this episode with Christopher Cole where we talked about exactly this, and what he mentioned was stuff like trend following and option strategies. So I guess the question is, in this type of an environment, does it favor asset managers who are able to manage risk on the fly?
Yeah, well, okay. That's another great question. And I'd like to tip my hat to Christopher Cole as well. I'd also like, just as a personal point, to do a shout out to Mark Serafini, who clued me in on a lot of these issues. But what will provide protection in the future? That's the question. If bonds don't, a lot of traditional allocation schemes are broken. Why? Because bonds had that double virtue of not only being the best Sharpe ratio performing asset class of the main ones, but also being the flight to quality security, or a security mix. So if you lose that, then I think a lot of traditional portfolio theory, at least multi-asset class portfolio theory, just goes out the window. So we're in deep trouble. So where are you going to get protection? Well, I've done a few studies. I did one with a guy, Mark Malik at Conquest, and some other people. And we basically found that longer-term trend following provides less protection than, as you suggested, shorter-term momentum trading, where if you chase shorter-term movements, you capture more of the total volatility across markets than you do if you're just sitting back and trading big trends or controlling your portfolio by looking at volatility and cutting volatile asset classes and putting money into other areas. That doesn't necessarily work. The other area, of course, is the VIX or volatility type products. Now, a lot of people used bonds for protection. Okay, that worked from 1982 to the present because we were in a secular bull market for bonds, coming down from 16 or 17% yields, say at the 10-year point, all the way down to where we are now, well below one. But volatility structurally should provide protection. Why? Because for risky assets such as the S&P 500 or the Nikkei or the FTSE or the Eurostoxx or whatever, when markets go down, they tend to go down more sharply than they go up. And we used to have the saying that stocks go up the stairs and down the elevator. In other words, sell-offs tend to be short, so most of the time markets rally. This is a basic qualitative thing, but when they do go down, they shank big time. And so that was a big issue. And I think volatility hedging is the number one way now to directly play dangers in existing strategies. Why? Let me tell you why. Because if everyone else is targeting volatility, if they're cutting positions in equities when volatility spikes from 15 to 30, if they're halving their position, then what you need is a strategy that actually benefits from those spikes, with low costs of carry, with low time decay. And that's the sort of thing that we're interested in. And my colleague and boss, Bob Daugherty, he focuses a lot on this, in terms of finding ways to buy volatility or to trade volatility in a relative value sense as a hedge or as a way to exploit fearful markets.
So this is what I want to get into in the overtime, Ari, because
Sure.
this is a lot of what your book is about. And I think it's going to be very interesting for listeners, especially fund managers, but anyone who's actually interested, because we get really, this is where we get really geeky here. So I hope for listeners who heard this first part, my hope was to give you guys a general philosophical overview of a very complicated subject. Hari's very good at this. And again, Hari, the name of this episode is actually the name of your book, The Second Leg Down: Strategies for Profiting After a Market Sell-Off. Anyone who's interested, well, stick around. And we're going to move into the overtime. For regular listeners, you know the drill. If you're new to the program or if you haven't subscribed yet to our Patreon, audiophile, autodidact, or super nerd tiers, head over to patreon.com/hiddenforces or scroll down to the bottom of the summary of this week's episode and click on the link that directs you to our Patreon page, as well as on the link with instructions for how to integrate the RSS feed into your favorite podcast application of choice, so you can listen to this overtime with me and Hari, just like you listen to the full episode. Hari, stick around. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Today's episode of Hidden Forces was recorded in New York City. For more information about this week's episode, or if you want easy access to related programming, visit our website at hiddenforces.io and subscribe to our free email list. If you want access to overtime segments, episode transcripts, and show rundowns full of links and detailed information related to each and every episode, check out our premium subscription available through the Hidden Forces website or through our Patreon page at patreon.com/hiddenforces. Today's episode was produced by me and edited by Stylianos Nikolaou. For more episodes, you can check out our website at hiddenforces.io. Join the conversation at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Hidden Forces Pod, or send me an email at dk@hiddenforces.io. As always, thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.